What I thought I would do today is to explore an aspect of the Brazilian dictatorship that's not usually accounted for, which is the relationship that it established with the Amazon. So I'll do a brief description of what the project of the Brazilian military regime for the Amazon was, and I'll talk briefly about a book that recently came out, The Falling Sky, Words of a Yanomami Shaman, which is a remarkable book, I think, in what it changes in the concept of what the collaboration between indigenous leaderships and anthropologists is. So without further ado, let me go ahead and start reading. The military dictatorship that ruled Brazil between 1964 and 1985 conjures images of left-wing activists tortured in police headquarters, presidential elections suspended, working class, peasant, and student leaders persecuted, political parties outlawed, and intense censorship over the arts, particularly over popular music. The Brazilian military regime was also unique vis-a-vis other South American dictatorships insofar as it was a modernizing, developmentalist dictatorship which displayed a grandiose conception of nationality predicated on modern roads, hydroelectric dams, large state-run firms of public service, and a massive civil military bureaucracy. Not only did the Brazilian dictators appeal to nationalism and anti-communism like the other South American regimes, they also had a unique cultural policy based on the mercantilization of popular culture, as well as remarkable investments in cinema and the mass media. That is to say, the Brazilian regime did not limit itself to being an anti-communist barrier, a killing machine in the service of capitalist interests, and a bulwark of privatization like its Chilean, Argentinian, and Uruguayan counterparts. Informed by a doctrine of national security, which identified both internal and external enemies to be combated, and invariably thought of those enemies as acting together in a conspiracy, it was not only, however, a repressive regime, it also produced a particular understanding of what the country should be. Unlike its Argentinian counterpart, the Brazilian regime had organic intellectuals. It had geographers, jurists, and so forth that were thinking Brazil from the standpoint of the doctrine of national security. Unlike its Chilean equivalent, its thinking was not limited to the tripod economic privatization, conservative Catholicism, and the doctrine of national security. Amongst the aspects most often overlooked in the bibliography about the Brazilian military regime is its unique project for the Amazon. The Brazilian military had a clear policy for the region, particular security concerns regarding it, a plan to populate and occupy it in disregard of those who already lived there. It had a distinct mission that it expected the Amazon to accomplish, both as an energetic colony and a source of raw materials for the march of progress. Above all, and that was the verb most widely used at the time, the Amazon had to be incorporated to the nation. The meanings acquired by this verb and its synonyms over the year, modernize, populate, bring up to date, offer a map of how the Brazilian generals conceived of the Amazon. Amongst the regime's organic intellectuals, Gouberi do Couto e Silva, responsible for the regime's geopolitics, was the foremost name in spelling out the dictatorship's plan for the Amazon, based fundamentally on an idea of occupation, which systematically disregarded the vast numbers of people who were already there. 357 is the official number of deaths and disappearances of the military regime currently recognized by the Brazilian state. But the acknowledgement of one single massacre of an indigenous nation in the Amazon, the extermination of about 2,000 Waimiri, Watruari individuals during the construction of Highway 164, would multiply this figure by six. As throughout the 1960s and 70s, the indigenous populations of Brazil were not visible as political subjects, this massacre is one of several events that have been forgotten in the historiography devoted to the period. It would not be an exaggeration to say that the extermination of Amerindians became official state policy during the Brazilian dictatorship, and the Waimiri-Watruari genocide is just one of the most visible parts of the iceberg, becoming visible now. In 1974, in the midst of the intense modernizing effort that followed the defeat of the armed opposition to the regime, between 1968 and 1973, an armed opposition to the regime, very small and very kamikaze, with no chances at all, developed in the urban centers. And there was one focus of rural guerrilla in the Amazon, close to the Araguaia River. During the construction of Highway 174 in the northern part of the state of Amazonas, that construction faced understandable opposition of the Waimiri Watruari nation as it cut through their territory and brought with it the usual pollution and ecological devastation that accompanies the constructions of highways in the midst of the very humid Amazonian forest. In a book published a few years later, in 1981, when the dictatorship was living its last moments, José Porfirio de Carvalho, a collaborator in the massacre, who was then coordinator for the National Foundation for the Indians, wrote, quote, "Among other administrative measures that were decided at that moment, it became established that the army would carry out within the Waimiri Atroari reservation a demonstration of force that would include systematic shootings, the explosion of dynamite and grenades in an attempt to scare the Indians and prevent them from interrupting the construction of the highway." The details of this genocide of 2,000 Waimiri Atroari individuals are not known, but we have had access to a 1974 Army memo from that very outpost that recommended 13 kinds of operations designed to produce terror in the Waimiri Atroari population. Show them the effects of intense shooting, defensive grenades, and destruction by the use of dynamite. This is a passage from this Army memo. In addition to Carvalho's book, published in 1981, almost as a confession of guilt, we also have a few interviews from that time which tell part of the story, such as the one given by Sebastião Amâncio, then newly named FUNAI. FUNAI is the National Foundation for the Indian. It was a state office created by the dictatorship in 1967 to replace the previous Service for the Protection of the Indian. He gave an interview to O Globo in January 1975, saying the following, "I will go with an army patrol to the Indian reservation, and I will give a beautiful demonstration of our power. We will shoot intensely their trees, we'll explode grenades, and we will make a lot of noise until the Waimiri Atroari become convinced that we have way more power than they do." This is in many ways astounding. A high-ranking public official under military dictatorship in the nightmarish conditions of 1975 Brazil concedes an interview to one of the country's largest newspapers and confesses the preparation of a genocide without much embarrassment or need to conceal details. That Amâncio's interview could appear in O Globo, which was then the second largest newspaper in the country, without causing much ado and visibly without worrying the military dictatorship, shows that actions of repression against indigenous populations had a distinctly different status than those directed against urban left-wing activists. Whereas in the latter, the regime would invariably produce false versions of the events in order to excuse the breaking of its own law, in the former, the regime did not feel the need to lie. In order to kill white left-wing activists, the Brazilian military usually fabricated a story that they attacked first, that they had committed terrorist acts, that they were captured and then attempted to escape, that they committed suicide in prisons, and so forth. In order to kill Indians, no fabrication of the kind was necessary. "We need to demonstrate the force of our civilization," sufficed as a justification. One of the many ways in which the military dictatorship targeted Amerindians, and which have been remarkably absent in the assessments carried out in the post-dictatorial period, was the construction of concentration camps, specifically for indigenous populations. In the state of Minas Gerais, in the southeast of the country, the National Foundation for the Indian maintained two detention centers in the cities of Resplendor and Carmésia, very small towns in the countryside of Minas Gerais, where over 100 individuals of dozens of different ethnicities were taken during the military regime. One of these concentration camps was called the Krenak Reformatory, and it systematized a number of repressive practices that targeted Brazilian Amerindians since way before the military coup. And one of the interesting aspects of this research is to show that actually there is very little discontinuity as far as Amerindian populations go. We white Brazilians tend to think of the military regime as a major cut in the democratic progression of the country. For Amerindians, the story is a little different, and there's way more continuity between what they suffered under the dictatorship and what they had been suffering all along. Among these repressive practices, beatings, whippings, the hanging of bodies upside down for extended periods of time, deprivation of light, water, and food, solitary confinement, forced labor, sexual violence against women and children. These are all practices that historiography has only recently recorded as regular forms of punishment against Amerindians in the Krenak Reformatory. Official documents now reveal that authorities themselves often did not know what the accusation against some of the Amerindians being held prisoners were. In spite of the fact that many of them were in these concentration camps for their struggle for land, they have never been recognized as political prisoners of the regime. Several victims of the Brazilian military regime have received, or their families have received recently in the past 15 years, indemnizations, but none of them were indigenous, even though Brazilian Amerindians were by far the regime's most numerous victims. Amerindians were also targeted in the repression against the rural guerrilla fighters of the Brazilian Communist Party that gathered around the basin of the Araguaia River in order to put together a highly unlikely revolution. This happened between 1971 and 1973 at a moment when the opposition to the regime had basically been defeated. Official recognition of this fact came recently, just a few days ago, in fact, as the Truth Commission offered political amnesty to the Aikawada people, who were terrified in their own land by military forces in the hunt for communist guerrilla fighters. The Aikawada became the first indigenous nation to be offered amnesty for events that took place during the dictatorship. And their recent letter states the following. It's in Portuguese. I'll translate as I go. During 3 years between 1971 and 1973, the Aikawada lived scared when they heard any noise from a car or a plane. They soon thought they were going to be dead. Many of them suffered from insomnia. They could not sleep because all the time they were being threatened by soldiers of the Brazilian army. The women would be frightened when they heard the translation of somebody from somebody who knew a little Portuguese, that the soldiers were ordering the children to shut up, and if they made any noise, they would be killed. And all the adult men of our reservation were taken as guides in the jungle, because we know the jungle very well. It's our land. Without food, walking for days on end, forced to carry heavy loads, under threats, and sleeping in the jungle and getting sick. This is a letter in which they recently present themselves as the first indigenous nation that received official amnesty. In the light of the horror undergone by Brazil's Amerindian populations during a dictatorship that ended 30 years ago, it is legitimate to ask, how has literature responded to the need to memorialize such horror? Have fiction and poetry been up to this mnemonic task? With a few exceptions, such as that of poet André Valías, who recently wrote an extraordinary poem establishing rhymes and rhythmic patterns with the names of all of Brazil's indigenous ethnicities, Brazilian literature has been remarkably absent from this task of memory. In a book written about 15 years ago that Chris was kind enough to refer to, it's The Untimely Present, Post-Dictatorial Latin American Fiction and the Task of Mourning, I argued that the task of mourning, the unresolved need to symbolically bury the victims of the military regime, victims here understood both as the persons killed by the regime as well as the ideals that were buried with the military dictatorship, that task, the task of mourning, was the primary task facing Brazilian, Argentinian, Chilean literatures. That task remains, particularly in Brazil, unresolved, and the growing awareness of the ordeal undergone by the indigenous populations adds yet another layer to this enormous task. As is usually the case, it has been the indigenous populations themselves who have most effectively memorialized their own history. And that fact forces us to step outside traditional literary fictional discourse. The most innovative ways in which indigenous communities have elaborated the memory of the atrocity also escape the traditional anthropological discourse in which the indigenous subject plays the role of an informant, translated and interpreted by the anthropologist. In particular, a recent collaboration by Brazil's foremost indigenous leader, Davi Kopenawa Yanomami, and the anthropologist Bruce Albert offers us an interesting model here. The Yanomamis are a nation that resides in the northern portion of the state of Roraima, which is the northernmost state of Brazil, along the border with Venezuela. And their contact with white Brazilians date back only to the first decades of the 20th century. As Albert relates, between the 1940s and the 1960s, a number of Protestant and Catholic missions, as well as SPI, the National the Service of Protection of the Indian, which was no protection at all, a number of outposts of SPY were opened in the outskirts of Yanomami territory. The turning point comes in the 1970s during the dictatorship with the construction of the Trans-Amazonic Highway, when countless Yanomamis are either massacred or died of measles or malaria brought, of course, by white people. The Trans-Amazonic is the great megalomaniac project of the dictatorship for the Amazon. It's a road that cuts through the entire forest. In the late 1980s, the world's attention was drawn to the Yanomami territory when the invasion of about 40,000 gold miners led to the massacre of about 1,000 Yanomami individuals. Again, through a combination of massacres, assassinations, and deaths by epidemics. The international consternation generated by this event, coupled with the emergence of Davi Kopenawa as an articulate, decisive leader of his people, created the political conditions for the demarcation of the Yanomami territory made official in the early 1990s. The Falling Sky, his collaboration with Bruce Albert, is, I would argue, one of the great intellectual reflections of our time. Kopenawa narrates his initiation as a shaman, the first contacts of his people with white Brazilians, the cosmology informing Yanomami culture, and delivers a scathing critique of Euro-Brazilian society. It would be too long to relate it all here, but one interesting aspect, and this is what I would like to explore in the 10 minutes that I have left, is the aspect of Yanomami cosmogony that relates how humans and animals came into being. And it's a story that is remarkably similar throughout the Amazon. And it has been explored and studied in anthropological literature, particularly by arguably Brazil's foremost anthropologist, Eduardo Viveiros de Castro, who has developed in the past 30 years a theory that he has called Amerindian perspectivism. And it starts from the ethnographic evidence that shows us that if there is one virtually universal notion within Amerindian thought, and Viveiros de Castro actually argues that you can find this from Alaska to Tierra del Fuego, all Amerindian peoples, is that of an originary state of indifferentiation between humans and animals. However, the original condition common to humans and animals is not animality, as it is for us, but humanity. In other words, Amerindian myths usually tell the story of how animals look the way they do because they have lost attributes proper to humans. So that's the contrast. Whereas for us, we are, in a way, former animals, right, who have evolved into Homo sapiens through a number of stages. For Amerindian thought, animals are former humans. They have lost attributes proper to humanity. And this is a kind of narrative that you find throughout the Amazon, regardless of the ethnicity that you're looking at. The narratives of Western anthropocentrism invariably tell the story of a passage from an animality that we share with non-human animals to the specificity of the human essence that only we possess. Amerindian thought invites us to think of animals as former humans. And the fall is never really an original sin as it is for us. It's usually a mistake. So, for example, for the Kayapos, alligators are former humans. They were humans who had to cross the river on a boat made of soft wood. But they got confused and crossed the river on a boat of hardwood and lost their humanity in that process, right? And became alligators. Several Amerindian myths tell the story of how jaguars, and jaguars are, of course, a very important animal because they are at the top of the predatory chain, right? They are the predator par excellence in the Amazonian biome. A lot of Amerindian myths tell the story of how jaguars shed their skins and reveal themselves as persons when they are away from humans. It is important, however, not to reduce that dynamic to our well-known opposition between appearance and essence. It's not that the body is understood as mere clothing hiding the true essence, but the opposite. Clothing itself is taken as a body. Remember that in Amerindian societies, animal masks are endowed with the power of metaphysically transforming the identity of their bearers. In other words, whereas we understand masks as an appearance that's hiding the true essence behind the mask, in Amerindian cosmologies, you usually understand a mask as a force that allows the body to produce and become something else. Humanity remains within animals, however, as a force visible only to the eyes of that species or to the trans-specific figure of the shaman. This is what a shaman is. A shaman is someone who can see the humanity within a certain species, a humanity that's visible only to the eyes of that species. The result is then that although we see ourselves as persons, that perception differs from the way other species perceive us and perceive themselves. In other words, we see ourselves as persons, but jaguars see themselves as persons too. In their eyes, we are nothing but wild pigs, prey. In Amerindian cosmologies, we can find countless references to a theory according to which humans see animals, the way humans see animals, is profoundly different from the way these beings see humans and see themselves. Typically for Amerindians, humans see themselves as humans, animals as animals, and spirits as spirits. But predator animals and spirits see humans as animals, as prey. On the other hand, prey see humans as spirits or animal predators, while predator animals and spirits see themselves as humans. In other words, they apprehend themselves and become anthropomorphized and experience their own habits under the sign of culture, not nature. They see their food as human food. Jaguars will see blood as cowim, as manioc beer, for example, and their corporeal attributes, beaks, claws, etc., as cultural instruments. Their social system is organized much like human institutions, with shamans, chiefs, feasts, rites, and so forth. When the jaguar sees you, he is the one who is a person. He's the one endowed with the attributes of personhood, consciousness, volition, and so forth. You are a prey. In other words, whereas the Western debate between relativism and objectivism addresses the primacy of a subject position vis-a-vis the object, in Amerindian perspectivism, we have a whole system altogether where the subject position itself is variable and can be occupied by humans, animals, plants, the earth, and so forth. One interesting thing that this ethnographic research has shown is that in Amerindian languages, the words used to name human beings function as a pronoun, not as a noun. They function as what we call in linguistics a shifter, a word with no meaning, a word whose meaning only that only acquires meaning once it's pronounced, words like here, tomorrow, I, you, and so forth. Whereas we see nature as a common ground from which different cultures took off and differentiated among themselves, Amerindian myths tell the story of how animals lost the attributes inherited or maintained by humans. Animals can be then, for Amerindian thought, former humans. For us, naturally, things are precisely the opposite. We are, in a way, former animals who have acquired or been endowed with the attributes of humanity, be they immortality, awareness of temporality, rationality, or in Marxism, the ability to produce and reproduce our means of existence, and so forth. One interesting, and this is leading towards my conclusion, one interesting anecdote that reveals this is told by Lévi-Strauss in Triste Tropique, his book about Brazil, where he relates that the arrival of the Spaniards in the Caribbean has one interesting story that we have all heard, that the Spaniards sent investigative commissions in order to find out whether or not Amerindians had souls. Right? We know that story. Bartolomé de las Casas is a major voice in that debate, arguing that Amerindians indeed had souls, etc. The other side of that story is much lesser known. The Amerindians from the Caribbean submerged Spanish cadavers, Spanish corpses, in the water for extended periods of time in order to find out if they were subject to putrefaction. In other words, for Spaniards, the question, the doubt was whether or not Amerindians had souls. For Amerindians, the question was whether or not Spaniards had bodies. There was no question that Spaniards had souls. Rivers have souls too. Jaguars have souls too. The question is whether or not they had bodies. And then there's this beautiful sentence with which Lévi-Strauss ends the anecdote. He says, both conceptions are ethnocentric, but one is more generous than the other. Personhood, therefore, for Amerindian thought, personhood is a position. It's not an essence, it's not a substance, it's a position. It's a locus of enunciation, it's a perspective which any species can occupy. Personhood is a phenomenological unity that's purely pronominal in kind. Therefore, there is no human essence insofar as humanity is a purely positional concept. Right? Well, how can this world where everything is human serve us as an antidote to anthropocentrism? Is that not a contradiction in terms? The distinction that must be grasped here is between our anthropocentrism and Amerindian anthropomorphism. instead of seeing humanity as essentially endowed with attributes that animals lack, right, which is the classic case in Western civilization. Fred Jameson, who was my dissertation advisor, told me one very interesting story once. He said, Delbert, when you see a philosopher talking about animals, you can bet that it's the essence of humanity that's being described, right? So in the classic Marxian formula, animals produce unilaterally, man produce universally. So that's the way we understand humanity and animality. On the other hand, Amerindian thought sees humanity as a point of view. We see ourselves as humans, but jaguars do too. They see themselves as humans, and they see us in turn as prey. This is a radical displacement upon a concept of humanity. If we all can be humans, then we are not so unique or special, right? Western anthropocentrism and Amerindian anthropomorphism are then not only rather different, but they imply, in fact, diametrically opposed stances toward the world and toward other species. Amerindian anthropomorphism is anti-anthropocentric, therefore, right? The lessons of Amerindian perspectivism become particularly relevant once we view them in the light of the current climate crisis, which is directly tributary to a conception of human rationality based on the domination, subjection, and exploitation of non-humans and nature. Our concepts of development, capitalist and socialist alike, have been predicated on the unspoken assumption, an illusion to be sure, that resources are infinite and the possibilities of exploring them endless. Confronted for the first time with the concrete vision of a global shortage of water, and as we speak, the city of São Paulo, the largest city in South America, has no water. Faced for the first time with that concrete vision, as well as with the fact that human activity has exceeded the biological productive capacity of the planet, the World Wildlife Fund has reached the conclusion that humankind is now using resources equivalent to one planet and a half. It is the very primacy of the human and the exclusivity of the human species as the only subject of rights that must be questioned. A copious bibliography in legal studies, I know there are a couple of legal scholars here, a copious bibliography of legal studies has elaborated on this point, showing how limited and impoverishing the anthropocentric conception of rights can be. More and more foundations have been laid not only for animals but also for nature itself to acquire the status of a subject endowed with rights. Both the Ecuadorian Constitution of 2008 and the Bolivian Constitution of 2009 are imbued with the lessons learned from Amerindian peoples in order to grant rivers, animals, and other non-human components of nature the status of subject endowed with rights. Article 255 of the Bolivian Constitution establishes a very interesting principle, quote, harmony with nature, defense of biodiversity, so far nothing new, but the ending of the article is very interesting. The prohibition of private appropriation for use and exclusive exploitation of plants, animals, microorganisms, and any living matter. The Bolivian Constitution explicitly prohibits the private appropriation of non-human animals and natural resources for private exploitation. When it comes to this renewed imbrication between cultural and ecological questions, Latin America is not a terrain among others. In a context of unprecedented devastation to the environment, the Amazon, as the world's greatest reservoir of biological diversity, concentrates some of the decisive political and ecological struggles of our time. The unprecedented ecological crisis of which we are both agents and, along with animals, plants, and the earth as a whole, victims, places us in a very
interesting crossroads. The ecological crisis is a clear case of what Timothy Morton has called hyper-objects. And hyper-objects are objects that defy our perception of time and space because they're distributed around the globe in such a way that we cannot directly apprehend them, and they produce effects the duration of which far outlasts the scale of human life as we know it. So the climate change is a hyper-object par excellence, right? We know for sure it is happening. It's not an empirically pointable, it's not an empirically situatable object. The ecological crisis is then at the same time obvious and invisible, urgent and long-lasting, specifically contemporary and radically untimely. How we respond to the task of coming to terms with it and whether or not we prove ourselves worthy of learning from Kopenhauer's lessons will determine not only our understanding of the present, but also the very possibility of a future. Thank you.